I'm Bob Andelman, and this is Mr. Media Interview. You can see, hear, and read more than 1,000 of my previous celebrity interviews at MrMedia.com. That's MRMedia.com. Subscribe to the show on YouTube, iTunes, Apple News, Google Play, or Stitcher, and follow us on Twitter and Facebook.
Yes.
How do you do?
How are you, sir?
All right. Thank you for taking the time to talk.
Thank you for your time.
Oh. You know, I want to ask you something right off the bat. I was just talking to someone. When does a person go from calling you Captain to Mr. Keeshan? What age does that happen at?
I think many people call me Captain at any stage in life, so feel free to call me whatever you'd like.
All right. I guess you're comfortable with either at this point.
Absolutely.
I'll be darned. Yeah, we were talking about how a maestro in a symphony would prefer to be called Maestro Hoffman as opposed to Mr. Hoffman because he feels it's something he's earned. In your case, it's something that's just, I guess, grown over the years.
Yeah, I really don't think that seriously about it either way, so call me Maestro if you want to.
Okay, Maestro. Thanks. How are you doing?
We're doing fine, thanks. Terrific.
You feeling good?
Yeah, I'm feeling absolutely wonderful, thank you.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I know you had some problems a while back.
Yeah, that's an ancient history now. It's over 3 years ago.
Yeah. What is the current status of Captain Kangaroo?
We're on CBS on weekend mornings on Saturday and Sunday, and we will be so until the end of the year. And at that time, as we've informed CBS, we'll be taking the show off the air because we are now searching for a time period on public television where we hope that we will be on Monday through Friday and be able to reach the audience that the program has been designed and produced for over the many years, that audience which we're not now reaching early on weekend mornings.
So there's a very strong chance that you will be on PBS?
Oh, I think there's a very strong chance. We've been talking to people in public television, in PBS, and in the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and many stations, and we have nothing but enthusiasm for the project at the moment, and the key factor really is the finding of underwriting, corporate support. As you probably know, public television is not a very wealthy system.
Right.
They have a great deal of difficulty in financing their operations, and especially since the president has seen fit to veto the latest appropriation for public television, they're in difficult straits. So we would have to find corporate underwriting to bring the Captain to public television. And so we're at the stage now where we're talking to corporations and seeking a far-sighted company that feels strongly about the future of the nation and to the extent that how we now nurture children through television is important to the future of the nation. So if we can find someone of that sort early on, we'll be on public television early on.
Well, what kind of company?
Any kind of company at all. It's an American company that's interested in the future of America. It could be anybody from McDonald's to Eastman Kodak to General Motors to Chrysler. Anybody who's forward-looking enough to know that the way we raise children is predictive of the future, and that if we don't raise children better than we have been nurturing them recently, we're going to be in trouble in this country. So any company that feels strongly about the future of America is a company that would be interested in this project.
Okay, all right. I was thinking in reading up and boning up, I'm one of the kids that, I guess everyone grew up watching the show. Most everyone.
Everyone under 50, maybe.
Yeah, okay. and, you know, I was reading what you had done before coming to the show, and I saw that, I guess you were about 22, 23 when you started playing Claribel?
I was 20 when I started playing.
20?
Yeah, I was an undergraduate, and working my way through college, and joined Bob Smith, who just started Heavy Duty, and worked with him on that program.
Oh, and then it was, what, maybe 6 years later that the Captain was born?
5 years later I left and did two programs in New York over a two-year period, one of which was very similar to the Captain, and invited CBS's attention, And in 1955, which was actually 8 years after we started on Howdy Doody, we started the Captain.
I see. What I was wondering was where someone so young, just coming out of teens and still in school and then moving on up, how someone gets and develops such a good instinct for children and to know how to interact with them so well.
Well, I suppose it's a good deal of on-the-job training and a good deal of research outside of television. I did not, on Howdy Doody, have any knowledge of the needs of children or how we could meet them, but in 1951 my son was born, and so I at that time began looking at television from a different perspective, viewing it as a parent, and showing some concern in those very early days of television about what we were doing to children through the viewing experience, and also fairly excited about the potential for using television to instruct and to advance the child emotionally and culturally. So I began seriously thinking and studying ways in which that could be done. And my whole approach to children changed radically. That was one of the principal reasons, of course, why I left Howdy Doody and struck out on my own, so that I might have producer's control and be able to do the sort of things that I wanted to do. And that I very much did from that point on. And of course, Captain Kangaroo represents the whole development over the period of time.
Do you recall what anything about your own childhood, the things you did at that same age as the kids that are watching you, the things that your parents had you doing to keep occupied and interested?
Well, I don't know whether I recall anything specific to the point where I would say, oh yes, I remember that experience from my childhood certainly influenced this particular approach or this particular device or whatever. But my childhood was a wonderful childhood. I had I don't have any sad stories to tell about it. It was idyllic, and even though there were difficult times, depression times, and domestically, and with war threatening overseas during the 30s and so on, those worlds were far from mine. I just lived a wonderful, comfortable, secure childhood, and I did, whether by accident or design, have parents who left me pretty much alone and helped me develop my imagination. Allowed me to have fun developing that imagination, and I think that I probably found a lot of my future was developed at that particular time. So I think if I had a different childhood, I probably would not have been able to do the work that I do today.
Are you an only child?
No, I have two older brothers and a younger sister.
I see. I had a longer question along that line. What did your father do, or does he do?
My father was a grocery executive. He was an immigrant to this country and worked his way up from delivery boy to vice president of the company. By the time I came along and was growing up, maturing in the 30s, he was an executive, and we were living a pretty comfortable life. He was a pretty great guy.
Oh, it's a very American type story.
It sure is.
Yeah.
He loved America. He was just about the most American I know.
You, of course, have three children?
I have three, yes. All old-timers. They're 29, 31, and 33.
Have they made you a grandfather yet?
Yes, I have two grandsons, both almost 3 years old.
Wow.
Great pleasure. Lots of fun.
Well, for your own children first, and then I guess your grandchildren now, if they're kind of young, how did your own children react to the Captain?
Well, not at all, because we never used them. We kept them far apart from it. They watched the program.
In that sense, yeah.
They watched it as any other child might do. They were never tested. They were never asked, do you like this, do you like that? As a matter of fact, they were never even told I was the Captain, and I did the Captain. Of course, they got to the age where they realized that. It's difficult enough for a child to grow up in almost any set of circumstances, and to make them, as so many of the Hollywood people do, make them a sort of minor celebrity of their own was something we didn't want to do. And we lived in a suburban community that very much respected our wishes in that respect, so they were regular, ordinary kids. Their childhood was probably the same as it would have been if I had been an airline pilot or an executive of a company or something of that sort. I don't think they lived any different life.
That's interesting. I just wonder how they, you were able to see, you know, whereas you got feedback, I'm sure, from other parents about how their children were taking to the captain, but I guess you were able to see firsthand from your own children how they were reacting, if they weren't aware of it.
Yes, to some extent, but they were never aware of it, and, you know, they were never aware that they were being observed in any way, and actually most of the time they were not being observed. If they felt very strongly about something, they might tell their mother about it in the same way that any child might say, gee, I like the dancing bear and what he did today, or something of that sort. But I never depended on them as a laboratory or in any other way. I just wanted to keep them as normal as possible and allow them to grow up as much as normal a way as possible.
Okay. Let's change gears a little bit. How good or bad would you say today's television for children is?
How good or bad is today's television for adults? then you've got to say to me, well, you know, some adults like some programs and other adults don't like other programs and so on. Because if we were to look at the juvenile audience, we have to recognize that the juvenile audience is not monolithic. It's not one individual. And therefore, one program is good for all and another program is bad for all. Children bring, as adults do, different backgrounds, different experiences, different stages of emotional development to a program. So for some children, a particular program is fine viewing. For other children, it's not appropriate viewing at all. Same is true with adults. So we have to recognize that there are millions of different human beings in the child audience, each one of them unique. No two have ever been born alike. So I'll give you a ludicrous example. A woman told me that her children couldn't watch the Donna Reed program. She wouldn't allow them to watch it. If you remember, that program was very saccharine, very sweet, nice mommy and nice daddy and so on. But she was a psychologist on a home for children in Houston awaiting adoption. They were 12 and 13 years of age, and they knew they would never be adopted. So they would watch this program and bring their peculiar or special experience with them and see all that they were deprived of, the nice home, the nice mommy, and the nice daddy, and so on. And it would lead them to aggressive behavior. They'd start punching each other out when the program was through. So she realized that their special experience made that a very inappropriate program. But no way in the world could you call it a bad program.
Right.
But with their experience, it was. And that's true of any program. Some children are able to, at their stage of emotion, cultural development, watch a particular program and benefit from it. Other children might well be harmed by that same program. So that implies that parents have a very great need, a great responsibility to intervene in the program selection of their children. And only with parental intervention is television going to be intelligently and wisely used for the development of their children. A lot of parents don't think anything, would never think of just sending their children out to play and not be concerned about who they were playing with or where they were playing or what activity they were engaged in. They're very much concerned about those real-life activities. And yet, in fact, American children spend much more time with their playmates on television and television program viewing than they do with their real-life sandbox playmates, and are being much more influenced by their television viewing than by real-life playmates. So parents ought to be at least as much concerned about their television playmates as they are their real-life playmates.
I found some stories that go back as far as 1960 that interested me in the sense that they were saying that at that point, Captain Kangaroo was the only actual children's program on the air. And that changed a little bit over the years, on and off. It, you know, others came and went and have stayed and so forth. And I'm wondering if there's ever a period in your mind where there was actually a quantity of good programming for children. If we've missed it, if a golden age, so to speak, of children's programming has come and left us.
Well, I think that there certainly was a good deal more programming for young people 15 and 20 years ago than there is today. There is none today, and there's no programming at all on the commercial networks Monday through Friday. There are some syndicated programs on commercial television on the independent stations, but most of them are animation from old Saturday morning and not, on the whole, of very high quality. We always have public television, of course, and they're excellent commitment to children, to Mr. Rogers and Sesame Street and Reading Rainbow and other such programs. But there was a day many years ago when NBC had programs like Rudy Kazooty and Ding Dong School, and ABC had Discovery and the Mickey Mouse Club and Mr. Wizard on a pretty regular basis, and CBS had Captain Kangaroo, and they had Lucky Pup, and so on. So there were a substantial number of programs, at least a quantity, most of them of fairly high quality. Maybe they weren't as educational as Sesame or Mr. Rogers or Captain are today, but they were certainly not programs that harmed the child in any way. Rudy Kazooty and Howdy Doody and so on were if maybe occasionally inane, they were still fairly good entertainment and did do well by children. That's changed, of course, enormously, and mostly because of economic reasons. Children's programming is no longer economically attractive to broadcasters, and therefore I don't think we shall ever again see it. For a while, we saw good constructive children's programming, even if it wasn't economically advantageous to broadcasters, because government insisted that broadcasters had a responsibility to program for special audiences such as children. And now, under the present Federal Communications Commission, broadcasters have no responsibility at all to program for special audiences. They don't even, as of 8 weeks ago, they don't even have to keep a log anymore.
Right.
So we couldn't even prove it if they had the responsibility. We couldn't prove whether they discharged it or not.
Mm. Do you think, I had read that you don't feel that children have changed over the years?
I don't think they really have. I think we can see differences. We can see, someone said to me the other day, children are so much more hip. Well, that's true. I think there's a sophistication there, but that's a surface thing. That's a veneer. They have a greater vocabulary, and they have a greater knowledge of the world around them than we ever did 30 or 40 years ago. And I think to a large extent that's because of their television viewing. But basically, when you get down beneath all of that, the child is very much the same as the child of 30 or 40 years ago. Who am I? Am I valued? Am I loved? Do I have a future? All those same questions are being asked by today's children as were asked a generation ago, and their nurturing needs are very much the same as children of that age.
Do you think that part of the key in coming up with a successful children's program that can work for the commercial networks, not necessarily on, but for them, has to do with maybe there's a different style of format or some kind that needs to be developed at this point for the kids?
The children's audience. You see, when I left Monday through Friday on CBS 2.5 years ago, I had a rating of 3.6, which was a very respectable rating, considering that I could only appeal to about 10% of the nation's population to begin with. The morning news replaced me in that hour, and last March, 2 years later, the morning news had a 3.6, exactly the same rating. So they got absolutely nowhere in building larger audiences, but what they did do was build a different character audience. They were now at 3.6 of adults rather than 3.6 of children. So instead of selling a 30-second spot for $3,000 or $4,000, they're selling 30-second spots for $25,000 and $30,000.
Mm.
So they're making enormous amounts of money compared to what they were making on Captain Kangaroo with exactly the same size audience. So unless they have a reason to program for children, they're not going to do it. And there is no economic reason to program for children.
Right. How, parts of New York, I guess, have been slow to wire for cable. But are you fairly familiar with the Disney Channel and Nickelodeon?
Yeah, I'm familiar with all of the services.
Oh, okay.
We've worked and talked to Disney and to Nickelodeon over the last few years, and they've all have very serious economic problems. The Nickelodeon Channel, of course, because of its sister company, Atari, has been in great difficulty, and they have not been able to spend the quite money they have. I think half the people that I talked to 2 years ago are no longer there. Their staff has been trimmed down considerably, and they're really not able to do very, very much. The Disney Channel, we were very serious with at one time when they were in partnership with Westinghouse before they actually went on the air. And then they split with Westinghouse and decided to do everything in-house at the Disney studios. But even if any one of those happened, we really wouldn't have access to very many people. Disney, I think, now reaches about 6 or 7% of the television homes in the nation. Nickelodeon, I think, reaches about 11% of the homes in the nation. It's not very impressive. When you start out with that small an access, you really can't build very much of an audience. And then I'm also a little bothered by the fact that you have to pay for both of them. You have to pay for the Disney Channel, and to get the Nickelodeon, which is a free service, you have to have cable service to begin with. And the people who need and use television the most, the children in homes below the poverty level, are the ones who certainly can't afford services like that. So that sort of thing bothers me. 20% of the children of this nation are living below the poverty level. That's 1 in 5. They're not getting the Disney Channel, and they're not getting Nickelodeon. And they're the ones who probably need it most, because there's no money in their family budget for recreation.
What do you think of the programming itself on the two channels?
Oh, I think it's fine. It can't be Disney. Disney's wonderful. he has a library of material that's awesome, and they are developing new material. I think if they ever get themselves straightened out with all these takeover attempts and so on, and management gets itself straightened out, we might see some wonderful things from Disney. Nickelodeon has just bought a new series. It's a very minor series, but they're making a good deal of it. But it only plays for less than 10 minutes a day. And when you're dealing with 14 and 15 hours a day in service, that's not a very big contribution. So they're a long way from it. I think cable television is going to be a long time in the touring. For example, I think family home entertainment is going to overtake cable in no time. I think producers such as myself will be spending more time and realizing a greater income a decade from now from family home entertainment than from cable or on-the-air broadcast television combined. So I just think that field is exploding. It's incredible, the things that are happening there. It's growing so much faster than cable. I think cable has some very, very serious problems.
Do you bear any animosity towards CBS?
No, not at all, because, first of all, it's not productive. It's not part of my nature to be vindictive or to dislike people. And the people involved in making decisions over the last few years that have displeased me are just doing what they have to do. If the FCC didn't tell them that they were free to do what they wanted to do, then they would have to go and make other decisions. But with that freedom and unshackling of their responsibility, the stockholders have got to get their due. The stockholders have got to get as much money as they possibly can at the bottom line. And if this particular executive doesn't do that job, then somebody else will come along and do it.
Right.
You can't hate a fellow for doing his job. I mean, I might have some strong feelings about the FCC and their doctrinaire feelings about letting the marketplace function and letting the marketplace take care of children. And God knows the marketplace certainly will take care of children, but not the way that we expect it to.
Are you comfortable in the role as... And maybe you've been put there by other people, or maybe it's intentional, but in the role as a leading spokesperson for children's television and children in general?
Well, I think it's my obligation to take a role of advocacy, not only relative to children and television, but everything in society, whether it be child abuse or education or any other facet of our society that impinges on and affects the way we nurture children is something that I've got to feel very strongly about, and in fact do. And I spend a lot of my time in education, I spend a lot of my time in health care, I spend a lot of time in organizations like the National Council for Prevention of Child Abuse, which has now become such a wonderful and popular subject, now that we find sexual abuse running rampant in schools. So it's always been there, but we've just discovered it as a wonderful new theme, and yet there are other kinds of abuse that are even more common that we should be concerned about. The ordinary physical abuse of children, particularly by their parents, and psychological abuse of children, which will break the will of a child and leave the child child with no self-esteem and unable to accomplish anything after 15 years of being told that they're no good and they're unable to do this and that. So I think that, yes, I think that I owe that to children. I feel that I feel very strongly that I'm able to take that role of advocate and let people know how strongly I feel that society needs to do a better job nurturing people.
You have received and been awarded diplomas and uncounted awards and such over the years. But is there any one that for any reason whatsoever just struck you closer to home and really was much more impressive that you treasure that much more than another?
Maybe just a personal one, really, that more than anything else. It doesn't have anything to do with my work, or it isn't valued any more than any other in a professional sense. But a few years back, I did receive a doctorate from Dartmouth, but coincidentally, on the same day, my son received his master's, and my daughter-in-law got her master's, and my daughter got her baccalaureate.
Come on.
All at the same commencement. So that was personally a day of great gratification, because we took 4 degrees from Dartmouth that day. It was a very warm day for us in personal terms. But professionally, of course, it wasn't any more meaningful than any other. I think the greatest satisfaction I get nowadays is what I'm going to be doing next week in Tampa, meeting the young people and people a little bit older than college kids who grew up with me and who will display the kind of warmth and affection in a personal way that's very, very pleasing to me now. Get the feedback from kids of 17 and 18 and 22 and older, 28, 30, some of those who have children now watching the captain, repeating their experience. That's really the most gratifying experience possible in human terms.
What kind of things were you talking about at the USF?
Well, pretty much the sort of things we've been talking about here today. We'll have a little bit of nostalgia going back and talking about my beginnings in the early days of television and that sort of thing, and we'll get right into to children and society and touching all the various subjects, because I believe that young people 18 and 19 and 20 years of age are in a position to influence the way children are nurtured today, even though most of them are not directly involved with nurturing children as parents, although they probably soon will be. But I believe that it's important early on for them to understand the needs of children, and I think they're also of an age where they can remember how they were affected in their younger days and how certain actions on the part of parents or society affected their decisions and their upbringing. So we'll be talking about children and television, and we'll talk about sexual abuse and children that run away from home, and how wonderful Paula Hawkins is with the Missing Children's Act and her persevering fight for that, and a whole range of subjects, how we feel about the nuclear war, how children are probably more affected by it than we older, more mature adults, and so on. So we'll run a wide gamut, and then when we get all through, we'll take some time for questions and answers to fill the gaps that may be open after my talk.
Okay. Do you remember coming to Tampa about 8 years ago, taping at Busch Gardens?
Yes, I do. I remember it very well. That was wonderful. That's a wonderful place. We had some wonderful footage that we came away with from there, some of which we still use, particularly in some of our musical numbers.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I just had a couple other short questions. If you have another couple minutes.
No problem.
When you first started, was there any way you could have guessed that you'd still be doing this today?
If I did guess it in those days, you'd probably be talking to me in an institution. Put me away. There's no predicting that kind of life.
Well, what I was wondering is, you probably thought, well, I'll do this for a few years and then I'll probably have to move on to something else. Did you ever think what the something else might have been?
No, because I never reached that point. I think from the very beginning it was fairly well established, and if there was something else, it would be something very similar. I don't think it would have been any kind of radical departure from what I'm doing.
Are I can't even say this with a straight face. Are Lumpy Branham and Cosmo Allegretti, are they still with you?
Yeah, they certainly are. They're fine. They're Lumpy is enjoying himself resting at his home in Pennsylvania, and Cosmo is playing tennis and doing an occasional role in a stage play here and there. So, yes, we talked to each other every few weeks on the phone, and they're standing by ready to go into production again when we need them.
Good, so they will be a part of whatever you do with PBS. I didn't know what their real names were until just last night, but their real names are so cartoonish.
Well, Lumpy is really, it's a nickname, of course. He got that when he was a teenager, and I don't know what it really means. His real name is Hugh, of course, Hugh Brown, which is a fairly conventional name. Cosmo comes from an immigrant family, and it was a very important family name.
Who actually created the characters that they
Well, the creation of a character is a community project. Writers writing a script, and maybe puppeteers making a character, or an actor designing certain parts of a character, and producers making suggestions that it go this way and that way, and then actually playing the character. The character may appear for the first time, but it's really 6 months or a year later that the character is pretty well defined. It doesn't have the definition the very first time out, but it will have 6 or 7 months later. And of course, everybody contributed to that. The actor, principally, of course, doing the character contributed, but writers and producers and everyone else involved with suggestions and material along the line do have something to do with what went into that character.
I know that my favorite character on the program was always Grandfather Clock.
Yes.
And maybe that's because I had a very strong grandfather, I don't know, but it always amused me. Can you tell me anything about how that particular character came around, or anything about it?
Oh, no, not really. It was nothing very unique about its creation. He came to the program about a year after the program started. We had a large knight in armor standing in the corner just as a decoration, and every once in a while he'd raise his arm and salute me and so on. And we found that a few children were frightened by the character. We received mail from the police telling us that when he moved and he clattered and he clunked, that it was a frightening thing, frightening image. So we decided, even if it was only 10% or 5% or 4% of our audience that was thus affected, that it would be a good idea to do without it. And we thought, well, what are we going to put in its place? And somebody said, how about putting a talking clock in there? So we designed a grandfather clock, and we gave Gus the opportunity to work it. It was very crude in its workings, but one of the writers said, let's have grandfather recite poems. And so primarily that's what he did. He did recite poems, and of course he fell asleep at the end of his poem. It was a utilitarian thing, really, because if he didn't fall asleep, we had to have Gus back there, and we needed Gus for other things. To free Gus, we had Grandfather fall asleep and stay there, and so we came back to him again.
Oh, that's great. Was there any character that you particularly had more fun working with than the other, just because of the, I don't know, for some reason it just interacted better with you?
No, not necessarily. Everything is different, you know. It's difficult to choose. Lumpy and I had a slightly different relationship than Gus and I had. We each had a very good relationship and enjoyed doing things. But Gus would react differently to things than Lumpy would, and it was fun playing with both of them.
What about like Mr. Moose?
Yeah, well, that's Gus again.
Yeah.
Gus is behind so many of those characters. Gus had different characters. His Moose was different than his grandfather,
right,
obviously, and very much different from his Dennis, which was a live character. So he displayed great virtuosity.
Someone asked me to ask you what was always in your pockets, if anything, was there?
It could have been anything. You know, in the early days, the pockets were large. It usually was something that came out of the pockets that led to something else, whether it led to Tom Terrific, or to some musical number, or whatever. The object that I pulled out of the pockets was a transition, an excuse to get to that particular thing. But there wasn't anything more than that. There wasn't anything mysterious in there, certainly.
You correct me if I'm wrong. You used to tell a story that the name was Captain Kangaroo because of the pockets?
Well, yes. And of course, it was unimportant to us in the beginning because we designed the show and what we were going to do and what the format was going to be and what the characters were going to be. And then at the last minute, somebody said, what are we going to call this thing? And that's really the least important aspect of a program, really. So we had to come up with a name, and alliteration in those days of Rudy Kazooty and Howdy Doody and so on seemed important. And so we thought it was the captain of a treasure house museum sort of place. We gave him a rank that a guide might have. And because he had large pockets and was in the pouch of the kangaroo, we assigned him Kangaroo, and Captain Kangaroo was alliterative and a little catchy, and that's really all there is to it.
Oh, very good. I have one last question for you, Mr. Keeson, or Captain, pardon me. I wonder if you have any advice for parents or for children, for that matter, or both.
Well, the only advice I have for parents, really, is the basic essential advice. I've always been amazed in recent history of the end of the program. We had a feature at one time where we would say to parents, you know, spend some time with your children and give them your time today. And it just amazed me after we started that I was actually getting letters, 10 and 12 and 15 a week, saying, I think that's wonderful, but what am I supposed to do with my children? What's happened to America that our parents don't know how to parent anymore? We seem to have bred that out of them. My mother never had any trouble figuring out what to do and how to spend time with me. And I think that's the most essential thing for parenting today. If we use television as a babysitter, if we fail to give time to children, then we're failing our children. You don't have to do anything fancy. You don't have to design some complex game that you're going to play with them. You don't have to think of some wonderful trip someplace you're going to go. All of those things are wonderful. But the most important thing, basically, is just spending some time, just having a conversation with your child. And that's not something you do when they're 8 or 9 or 10 years of age, but something you do from the time. Listen, Jerome Bruner up at Harvard says that children are listening to you when they're a day old and 2 days old, and that's important to talk to them intelligently from that point on. And I believe that. I believe that an intelligent conversation between parent and child, which takes time, is going to make for a great parent-child relationship. And you're never, ever going to have a problem with that child if you have that relationship.
Is there anything you would say to kids if you had a...
Yeah, just enjoy yourself, relax, and have fun. You're different. There's never been anybody like you born in this world. You're unique, and you have a great future, and you're valued by all of us. So just be confident that you can do anything you want to do, and take great pride in accomplishing those things. Self-esteem is the most important thing that we can give young people, and we can make them feel important about themselves, let them know that they are valued, they can do anything. Without self-esteem, there's nothing in this world they can do. There'll be failures. You can predict failure. Any psychologist, a teacher, can show you a child of 7 or 8 or 9 with low self-esteem, and it's predictive of failure. It's got to be, unless something intervenes to change that child in a few years.
Very good. Captain, I'm very grateful for your time. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed talking to you.
Looking forward to seeing you next week.
Looking forward to being there.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Letterman used to say, send it right off to the broadcast museum.